skies. Others showed views of the Earth as seen from space. The largest one, taking up almost the entire wall opposite Dan's desk, was of the spidery wheels-within-wheels structure of the Venezuelan space station Nueva Venezuela. Dan had taken that photograph himself, just as he had built the station itself. Behind his desk, on the wall over the low bookshelves built in there, was a framed page from a 3-year-old issue of Forbes magazine. It showed a color photograph of Dan sitting at his desk in his old office in Houston. As a portrait, Dan found it amusingly deceptive. He was looking squarely into the camera, grinning boyishly, a grown-up Tom Sawyer playing business tycoon. His gray eyes sparkled, his sandy hair was tousled as if he had just been engaged in some strenuous action. He was in his shirt sleeves, tie slightly askew, one hand reaching for the keypad of his phone terminal. Dan knew that he was no beauty. Yet his rugged, unhandsome features seemed to intrigue women. It was the smile that got them, he thought. The smile in the eyes. His nose was too big for his own liking and still slightly bent from the time it had been broken during a drunken, low-gravity fistfight on the moon. A Japanese mining engineer had made a wisecrack about American stupidity, and Dan had tackled him and his 3 compatriots. He had never taken the trouble to have the nose straightened, even after he had become so wealthy. Dan told himself he was not that vain. His plentiful enemies said he was too vain to correct the imperfection. The text of the article that accompanied Dan's picture had been written by a young woman who had thought herself a hard-probing reporter, too tough and sophisticated to fall for a grown-up Tom Sawyer. She started the article by describing him. A throwback to an earlier era, Daniel Hamilton Randolph is probably the richest 35-year-old industrialist in the world. Scion of a genteel Virginia family that traces its roots back to Thomas Jefferson, this former astronaut, former lunar mining engineer, has created the first multinational corporation to crack the $1 billion per year mark entirely through space industries. Randolph is not a big man physically, but he has the inner toughness that comes from making his own way in the world. Unmarried and handsome enough to head Playgirl magazine's 10 Most Wanted Men list, Dan Randolph has the brilliance, the drive, and the towering ego of a latter-day Ted Turner. His desk phone chimed, and Dan snapped his fingers in answer. The phone terminal spoke with the dulcet voice of a professional actress whom Dan had once admired enough to buy her an apartment in New York. Her voice, it turned out, had been the sexiest part of her. "Dr. Freiberg to see you, Mr. Randolph." Glancing at the growing puddle on the carpet by the window, he growled, "Where the hell's the maintenance man?" Picking up on the key word, the phone replied, "Maintenance department was called 1 hour and 37 minutes ago. Do you wish to call again?" "You're double-damned right I do." The phone made no response. It did not understand Dan's vehement language. He huffed, then said slowly, "Yes. Call the maintenance department again, repeat the same message, and add that I will deduct any damage to my carpeting from the rent." "Yes, sir," said the phone, "and Dr. Freiberg." Dan nodded. "Right, let's have Dr. Freiberg by all means." Zachary Freiberg, Ph.D., appeared almost instantly in the chair at the left side of Dan's desk. His holographic image, projected by laser equipment built into the ceiling, scintillated slightly. It was solid enough to look real, although Dan knew that if he extended his hand, it would go through empty air. He could see faintly the photos on the far wall through Freiberg's 3-dimensional image. The scientist was slouching slightly in the chair, cross-legged, his eyes focused slightly away from Dan. "Hello, Mr. Randolph," said Zachary Freiberg. He was a youngish man with curly, strawberry blonde hair flopping down boyishly over his broad forehead. His face was round, apple-cheeked. An open-necked shirt, its pocket stuffed with pens, rumpled denims and feet bare except for sandals that were cheap imitations of Japanese gaitas. Dan got an impression of youth and lazy softness. He suppressed a frown, feeling suddenly overdressed in his own informal shirt and slacks. "Dr. Freiberg," Dan forced a smile. "How's the weather in California?" Freiberg grinned back at him. "Sunny and warm. What else?" Unconsciously, Dan sniffed at the dank air of his office. No matter how much he spent on air conditioning, the place always smelled slightly fetid to him, as if the jungle beyond the city's limits were sneaking back in to reclaim the territory that humans had tried to steal from it. Not even Houston, for all its humidity, was as bad as this. Today, with the tropical torrent tumbling out of the skies, the air felt musty and almost chill. Dan knew it was more in his imagination than reality, but still he nearly shuddered. "We're about ready for Noah's Ark here," he said, making a joke of it. "Yes," Freiberg said. "I can see the rain coming down past your window." "On both sides of it," Dan groused to himself. Aloud, he said, "Dr. Freiberg, I thought that you were all set to join us here at Astro Manufacturing. Now my personnel manager tells me there's a hitch. What's the problem?" Freiberg's round face grew serious. His eyes strayed slightly away from Dan's, avoiding direct contact. "Well, he stammered, it's a little embarrassing." Dan said nothing and waited for Freiberg to sort out his conflicting emotions. The scientist looked overweight to Dan, both physically and emotionally, still wearing his baby fat. But Astro Manufacturing's chief scientist and personnel director both insisted that Freiberg was the best planetary geochemist they could find. He was the man they needed, and therefore the man Dan wanted to hire. Freiberg had agreed to this appointment with Dan, so obviously the man was willing to talk. It would just take him a few moments to get over the hang-up of politeness. Dan had learned years earlier that most people would rather make asses of themselves than say something they considered impolite. They were trained from childhood to be pleasant and never utter a word that might upset someone. "If you can't say something nice, say nothing at all," was the wisdom that long generations of parents instilled in their trusting offspring. So the kids grew up to tie themselves in knots, holding back their true feelings, smiling when they wanted to spit. And they wound up paying exorbitant fees to psychologists or going to pop therapy courses, where they finally liberated themselves enough to be able to say in public, "I've got to go to the bathroom." Freiberg squirmed in his chair and twitched for a few moments, then said at last, "The problem is that all my friends tell me I'd be almost committing treason if I went to work for you." "Treason?" Dan snapped. "A lot of people here think that you're a..." Freiberg's face reddened. "Well, a traitor." Chapter 5. Dan leaned back in his leather chair and eyed the younger man carefully. He had expected something like this. At least it was out in the open now. Carefully, calmly, he replied, "According to the Constitution, treason consists of giving aid and comfort to an enemy of the United States. That's merely the legal definition. Do you think I'm a traitor to the United States because I've moved my corporation's headquarters to Caracas?" "You left the country." Dan forced his voice to remain calm, reasonable. "In a sense, Dr. Freiberg, you could say that the country left me. I'm in the business of running factories in orbit. The United States government decided to close down all its space activities and revoke the operating licenses of all the firms working in space. I had no choice. It was either leave the country or go out of business." "Yes, I know that, but..." Dan made himself relax and grin. "Now look," he almost added "kid," but held it back. "My motto has always been, when the going gets tough, the tough get going, to where the going's easier." Freiberg did not laugh. He merely looked more uncomfortable than ever. Dan abandoned his attempt at humor. "The American government gave up all its space operations at the insistence of the Russians. You know that, don't you?" Freiberg nodded glumly. "So, in a sense, if I'm working against anyone or anything, I'm working against the Kremlin. I'm carrying on the work that America would be doing if Washington hadn't caved in to the Soviets." "But it's not that simple," Freiberg objected. "A lot of people think you just ran out because you could make more profits in Venezuela." "Christ," Dan swore silently. "Spare me this neoliberal twaddle." "You left a lot of people without jobs here," the scientist added. Dan said carefully, "I brought as many people with me here to Caracas as I could. If I had allowed the American government to shut down Astro Manufacturing completely, as they were going to do, then all of Astro's employees would have lost their jobs. I really had no other choice." "There's still a lot of resentment here about you, a lot of hostility." "I'm sure there is. But are you going to let that kind of petty jealousy decide the future of your career?" Freiberg started to reply, but hesitated. "Look," Dan said, as sweetly reasonable as he could manage to be, "the United States has agreed to halt all its operations in space. Washington turned over the American space station to the United States.